Welcome to a special WUKY News Team program examining the topic of voting in the age of COVID-19. I'm Alan Lytle. For the next hour, you'll hear from election officials, voters, political observers, and others all grappling with the challenge of casting and counting ballots during a global pandemic. To quote the Grateful Dead, what a long, strange trip it's been, not just for voters, but for the candidates seeking higher office. Recently, I had the chance to talk about this unusual election cycle with the director of the UK Institute for Rural Journalism and Community Issues, Al Cross. Clearly, the 2020 election cycle is unlike anything we've seen before, certainly in this century, with more absentee balloting, early in-person voting, and possibly waiting days or even weeks for results to be certified. How would you characterize the state of voting in Kentucky as we get set to elect not only a president, but locally a representative to Congress and a U.S. senator?
I think the election process is actually pretty up to speed. And we have a bipartisan process set by the governor and the secretary of state with the Board of Elections and county clerks. There's been a logical process for expanding voting opportunities with more polling locations than we had in the spring. There's an ability to cure absentee ballots that don't follow process exactly. There's expanded early voting, including on Saturdays. So it's really hard to imagine how they could have set it up much better.
Now, normally incumbents enjoy certain advantages when it comes to re-elections. Do you see that situation changing this time around?
Well, it's a volatile time, and that should be risky for incumbents, but perhaps a lot of voters want to stick with the devil they know rather than the one they don't. I think there's some buyer's remorse over President Trump's election. He's not polling quite as well in Kentucky this time as he did last time, but he'll still win the state by double digits. Basically, it boils down to individual races and what people think of those incumbents. And in Senator McConnell's case, he's been able to make the race as much about his opponent as about himself.
Talk about how the nature of campaigning has had to change given the current COVID-19 pandemic we're in.
It's a lot less personal. It's more virtual. It relies more on electronic and telephonic voter contact. I think it's been a handicap for Amy McGrath, who really needed to go out and stir up some enthusiasm among Democrats after a primary in which she was hurt. She has been making stops around the state, but if you can't get a crowd together and generate some excitement, then you have to find other ways to do it. Now, certainly she has plenty of money to do that with, but money only goes so far. At some point you reach diminishing returns, and she probably has more money than she can spend at this point.
Now, it's been said people tend to vote with their pocketbooks, but with so many people out of work or working from home or even taking pay cuts, how do you see that playing out as they cast their ballots?
It's hard to say. I think people generally will revert to their longstanding beliefs. I wonder if it won't have some effect on the turnout. I think unhappiness often drives voter turnout. And I think in this situation, voting is something normal. And people want to do normal things. They want to return to normal life, as the president said recently. So the act of voting is an act that says there are things that should and must continue, and I'm going to take part in it, and we'll get through this. So that may actually help turnout.
Other than the economy, what other issues do you think will drive people to the polls?
Well, it depends on the race. With the presidential, I think it's almost entirely about the president. You know, there's polling that shows that Biden voters are driven much more by their feelings about Trump than they are their feelings about Biden. And the issue in that race, of course, is the president's handling of the pandemic. McGrath is trying to make that the issue in the Senate race, but she's making that argument after, I think, the great majority of people have made up their minds. And even though she's got plenty of money and lots of new ads that are pretty good, I think people have made up their mind in that race, and it's going to be very difficult for her to overcome McConnell's lead.
Now, President Trump remains popular in Kentucky, and the Commonwealth is not expected to be a battleground state, but his poll numbers are slipping elsewhere. I'm thinking of the Lincoln Project, for example. Why do you think so many Kentuckians favor his style of governing?
In the last 30 years, Kentucky has had a Republican trend. Trump has essentially taken over the Republican Party. He once said, I love the lesser educated, and this is a lesser educated state. I think there's one important theme to Trump's election in 2016 that a lot of people miss, and that is it was primarily a rejection of elites, social elites, economic elites, media elites. In other words, you people are not going to tell us how to behave and think. We will make our own decisions. And I think that was a very important part of Trump's appeal. And I think it's a big part of his Kentucky appeal because Kentuckians know that their state is not all that well off. And that's sometimes the butt of the jokes from people on the coasts. And means it's fertile ground for a candidate who's campaigning against elites.
Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear will not be on the ballot this year, but do you see him looming large in several legislative races in the state?
He will be an issue in some legislative races. We have a very interesting race for the state Senate in Franklin, Woodford, Anderson, Owen, and Gallatin counties, the seat being given up by former Governor Julian Carroll. One of my students writing for the Midway Messenger, our online paper for Midway, has a story this week pointing out that a big thing separating the candidates is their view of how Beshear has handled the pandemic. And I suspect that is going to be an issue in a number of legislative races.
Anything else we need to talk about that I may not have asked you about?
Well, I hope voters don't forget the constitutional amendments, which will be on the reverse side of their ballots. We have the Marcy's Law Amendment for notification of crime victims. Then we have the amendment to lengthen some judicial terms. And what people need to understand about that is it's really intended to allow recircuiting of the circuit courts in Kentucky, which are badly out of whack in terms of caseload. It's very difficult politically to do that without coordinating the terms of circuit judges, Commonwealth's attorneys, and district judges. And this would coordinate them as of 2030. And that would enable recircuiting to take place. And recircuiting has needed to be done for more than 50 years. So the other side of that debate, of course, is the lengthening of terms at a time when people have less trust in elected officials. District judges would serve 8-year terms like other judges. A lot of people think that is too long. There are methods, though, to get rid of judges who misbehave.
And finally, Al, what would you say to people who are still on the fence about casting a ballot this year?
I think the polarization of our political system has driven a lot of people to just throw up their hands and say a pox on both houses. But they ought to think about that. You know, here we have both sides using rhetoric of democracy at stake, good versus evil, you know, this really Manichaean sort of choice, which should suggest to people that something important is at stake here. And as citizens, they have an obligation to other citizens to take part in democracy. So don't just throw up your hands. Take a look and cast your best, most informed vote.
Our thanks today to Al Cross with the Institute for Rural Journalism and Community Issues at the University of Kentucky.
I'm Karen Czar for WUKY News. There are more ways to vote in Kentucky than ever before in our history, but time is running out. We want to thank Secretary of State Michael Adams for joining us to go over those last-minute questions before Election Day on Tuesday.
Well, it's never been easier in Kentucky history to vote than it is this year. That's one silver lining of this pandemic is we've made voting easier. There are four ways people can vote: absentee ballot by mail, absentee ballot by drop box, early voting in person, and voting on November 3rd in person. The deadline to request an absentee ballot has already passed. As of Saturday night, about 73% of the absentee ballots have been received back. That's very, very good news. We want people to return these as quickly as they can for two reasons. One is we're concerned about postal delays. The other is the sooner we get it back, the sooner we can spot a potential issue and give the voter a chance to fix the issue to make sure we can count that ballot. So we're actually well ahead of schedule on getting these absentee ballots back. Again, you don't have to trust the post office. If you don't, that's fine. We spend about $600,000 buying drop boxes and putting those all over the state. So you can use the drop boxes. What Governor Beshear did, the First Lady did, the Lieutenant Governor did, they've all used the drop box. What also is going well is our in-person early voting. We've had so far 529,000 voters vote early in person. We're encouraging people to do that if they can. We're trying to avoid long lines on November 3rd. Instead of just one election day, this year we've got 19 election days. 19 days, 6 days a week for 3 weeks, plus, of course, November 3rd. That helps us space out the crowds. We really don't want to have people jam the polling sites. We're concerned about our poll workers and, of course, our voters. We're trying to ensure social distancing. So by having people 6 feet apart, it just gets easier to process all of these folks if they vote over a period of days.
Secretary Adams, you talked about the drop boxes, and I've talked to several of the county clerks because of the issue that happened in California where people were putting up fake drop boxes. Every clerk that I've talked to basically said they're willing to prosecute if anyone tries any of that nonsense. What's your stance, and how are you preventing and keeping an eye on making sure that doesn't happen?
I've got a really good bipartisan working group with the Attorney General, the State Police from the Beshear administration, federal prosecutors, the FBI, Homeland Security, and so forth. And fortunately, by having a bipartisan approach, we've not had the sorts of problems you've seen in Texas and California. We've really depoliticized all of this. People are attacking drop boxes, and you've not seen that here. Republicans love the drop boxes. We haven't let this narrative take place that there's a Republican way to vote or a Democratic way to vote. We've tried to be bipartisan about it so people will just vote. So we have not had, fortunately, at least so far, any credible threats of people intimidating voters, of any people putting up fake drop boxes, none of this stuff. And I think part of the reason for that is because we've depoliticized the administration of this election.
Well, even you bring that up, even when you first announced what the procedure would be, you and Governor Beshear were next to each other, social distanced, yeah, next to each other, giving the announcement. So there seemed to be not a lot of resistance behind the scenes. Everyone seemed to be on the same page.
Yeah, and that makes a big difference. One of the reasons that Wisconsin's primary was such a debacle, and Ohio's was such a disaster, was that you had these different branches of government, different parties suing each other, backbiting and so forth. And what it meant was the rules weren't clear and well established in advance. And people got disenfranchised, people got sick. The election day was called on and then off and then on again. It was a mess. You didn't have that here. That's the biggest lesson that we learned from those states is depoliticize this. Reach an agreement, work it out, and then that leaves you time to inform the voters, time to train the poll workers, and so forth. But it also just makes the whole system less toxic.
What were the lessons learned from the primary going into the general election that you were able to tweak and improve upon?
Well, the first thing is I was pleasantly surprised at how open-minded Kentuckians were to voting in a different way. The way we do elections before this year, that was established in the 19th century. And we've been voting the same way since an agrarian era in our history, really haven't modernized. I was a little skeptical that we would be able to persuade people to try something different, but we actually did a pretty good job of it. I think, again, back to the politics of it, you had the Democratic governor and the Republican Secretary of State on the same page, and that really helped us get people to assist us. And so we had a very high proportion of absentee ballots in the primary. It worked really well. We felt like we really hit the load capacity of those ballots that we had, and going into a general election with turnout 2.5 times as high as you would have in a primary, we couldn't make that the sole basis for people to vote. So the big challenge was to expand early voting. And I'll tell you, I've been all over the state the last couple of weeks, talked to a lot of Republicans, and they love early voting. I don't know anyone who doesn't. Even the clerks like it, and they're the ones that have to actually put it on. So that may be one thing that we take out of all of this for a non-emergency election in the future, is to keep early voting.
there are some changes. You don't have to go to a particular polling place, things like that. What should you make sure that you have with you if you are going to vote in person?
If you're going to vote in person, make sure you bring a photo ID. We do have provisions in place if you don't have one or can't get one. But if you have one, please bring it. It's going to make this go much, much smoother. In most counties, you can actually vote at any of the voting locations. You don't have to vote in your precinct. Some counties you do. But every county has at least one place any voter in that county can go vote without regard to precinct. That's actually a proposal I made even before the pandemic to the legislature, is offer vote centers. A lot of people get disenfranchised because they go to the wrong precinct. They don't know any better. They moved, what have you. This makes it much easier for the voters to just be able to go to a place they know that they can vote. So in Fayette County and Jefferson County, actually in most of our counties, all of the locations to vote are all vote centers. So you can vote wherever's most convenient for you.
And the clerks I've interviewed have said, please don't wait till that last day. We've opened this up for a reason, because there still could be huge lines. And once we hit the third, that's it.
Yeah, gosh, go vote now. Most voters I know, they know how they're going to vote. They're pretty opinionated on one side or the other, so go vote already. If you're voting absentee, go and get it back to us. The sooner you do, the better. If you're going to vote, go do it now. Why would you wait in line unnecessarily? In 2016, I waited in line for 3.5 hours to vote for president. This time, I waited 30 minutes. And I got there right when the polls opened the first day. It's much easier to vote if you vote early. And you're going to help society, too, by helping us reduce these lines.
I want to thank Secretary of State Michael Adams for joining us. I'm Karen Czar with this special edition of Elections 2020.
The Beaumont Center Library has processed more Lexington voters than any other early voting location in the city. WUKY's Arlo Barnett spoke to voters and staff there about their impressions of the early voting process.
A steady stream of voters came through the Beaumont Library when I visited on a chilly, rainy morning less than a week before Election Day. Lisa Moore is the Fayette County Clerk's Beaumont liaison.
Yeah, the first day we had about 800 people that came through. And now we're averaging a little over 400, almost between 450, 470-ish, around there. So, you know, we're pretty consistent, even in weather like today where it's inclement. We still get a pretty, you know, decent amount of foot traffic.
Despite the high turnout, nearly every voter said the process was quick and easy, many using one word in particular.
Smooth. It was very smooth. It was well organized, and everyone was very friendly.
It was a very smooth process. Very smooth.
It went well. It went very smooth, very quick. It was probably a little easier than I thought it would be.
Given everything, this is as smooth as can be, I think. So, very well pleased.
It has gone extremely smoothly. It really has.
That last voice belongs to Moore, who said they've been able to control foot traffic within the library while maintaining appropriate distance for COVID-19. Most voters seemed to agree that walking through the location felt medically safe. But not everyone was sure this year's voting methods are safe when asked why they chose to vote early in person.
I just knew that it would be very crowded on Election Day, and I have asthma, so I just really wanted to protect myself from the large crowds.
Election Day, I figured it would honestly be really busy, and I didn't really like want to wait in lines or anything. And then the mail-in ballot, I don't know, I guess I don't really trust it, so I just wanted to like do it hands-on.
I wanted to leave space open on Election Day for people who can't vote early. I do not trust mail-in voting. I can't even get my bills in the mail right, so I sure as hell wasn't going to trust my ballot to go where it was supposed to go. So
I have to work on Election Day, so that it was just easier, and I like doing it in person versus kind of trusting somebody else. If I mail something in, somebody else to hand it to another person and another person, and you know, praying and hoping that it gets in the right place.
I would never mail in a ballot, and anybody that mails in a ballot is an idiot.
Some voters stood up for the security of mail-in voting, and most others said they at least felt secure casting their early ballot in person, regardless of any disenchantment with the state at large.
Well, anyone familiar with Kentucky governance can always question either the competence or other issues, but basically, there was nothing here to suggest improprieties that I saw.
Liaison Lisa Moore vouched for the security of her operation, which is using paper ballots, which are then scanned into a machine.
It's kind of like the police, you know, when you're watching CSI, and you have the chain of custody. So here, the chain of custody is from one election officer to another. And when they're feeding them into the actual machine, you get something back from the machine if it's an error. So if it's not an error, then the ballot goes through. So I feel certain that you can rest assured that your vote's going to be tabulated properly.
Some voters rejected the idea of expanded early voting altogether, even to accommodate the coronavirus pandemic.
I think it's ridiculous. I think that we should have to go to our own polls the way the law intended and show your ID. And I think that you should also get some proof of who you voted for so there can't be no chicanery. I don't appreciate this process, but it's the way it is because of COVID. If you can go get your car fixed, go out and go shopping, you should be able to go to your poll position where you're supposed to cast your ballot in your district and cast your ballot on election day. But everybody's scared to death, so oh well.
Others thought expanded early voting is a good idea during the pandemic, but favored a return to normalcy for upcoming elections.
I think in these times right now with the pandemic, it was an excellent alternative, and I think it was a great option, whoever thought of it. But I think when it gets back to some sort of a normal, I prefer to do it back the other way. And I say that is because there's many days. Okay, so there's many days, you know, is the information going through all the time? And we're really just talking about like data transfer in one day versus data transfer for 3 weeks.
I think that, you know, if you vote too early and some things may come out, you may have the, I don't know if you'd say voter's remorse, because, you know, something like economic numbers were released this morning that were really good. There were some things that were released in the last few days for a candidate that weren't so good. If you voted earlier, that might have affected your vote. So I still truly believe that the first Tuesday of November should be the day.
This year is different, not able to have as many polling locations open. I see the necessity of having it available a few weeks before. But I think when you take normal circumstances into consideration, I've never, ever even had a problem on a regular voting day. So I can see it is an exception being way early, but not as a general rule.
Still others think this kind of early voting should happen every election as a way to make sure that everyone, regardless of mobility or scheduling issues, can let their voice be heard.
I would support them offering this every year as the alternative to the one-day rush.
Yeah, it's without any hitch. We should do this pretty much every year. It increases the amount of people that are voting, and it just stops the congestion. I hope people actually like this idea that we can have a week, or even if it's just a week early. Higher turnout, it's more fair. So yeah, I just think there's nothing wrong with convenience.
Whether or not expanded early voting becomes a regular thing after 2020, Kentucky voters are turning out in record numbers prior to this election day. And according to them, at least at Lexington's Beaumont Center Library, the process is fairly smooth. Arlo Barnett, WUKY News.
This year, like thousands of other Kentuckians, I decided to vote by absentee ballot, and I wanted to share the process with you. So what better person to sit down and talk me through it than Fayette County Clerk Don Blevins?
I have received my absentee ballot.
Yes, you have.
Okay, so we open it up, and inside we have two envelopes and then my ballot form.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so tell me what we need to do first.
What I would suggest you do is go through the races and then ink in the bubbles that you want to vote for. So okay. For the public, while you're doing that, if you vote straight party, which is fine, then you may, if you like, override your straight party selection for individual races. So always the individual race is the one that wins, if you will, even though you may or may not have selected straight party. You do need to use blue or black ink.
Okay. So the first thing we want to do is fill out the official ballot.
Correct. So I'm watching Karen fill in her bubbles on the front side of the ballot. And then I'm going to remind her that there's actually two constitutional questions on the backside she needs to remember to fill out.
Okay. Hold on. I'm almost... Don't look. It's private. And no pencil.
No pencil.
Okay.
Blue or black ink.
Why is that? Why can't you use a pencil?
It helps the scanner understand what your selections are. The scanners are really cool. You can stick it in any way, upside down, backwards, it doesn't matter, and they figure it out.
So I filled out my front page, which is basically the major races.
Right.
And now, on
did
the
you
back.
Did you have a nonpartisan race? Did your ballot happen to have one for like council or something?
Yes.
Okay, well, we need to point out for other people that if you do a straight party selection, you still need to vote those nonpartisan races, because if you don't, you won't have voted at all. And same goes for the backside. Your straight party selection doesn't affect the constitutional amendments either.
Okay, and so we have two amendments. What if you make a mistake?
Yeah, if you make a mistake, what you want to do is indicate clearly which one you meant to do.
So I made a mistake.
Uh-huh.
So I won't tell you what I made a mistake on, but I made a mistake and I'm in ink. So what do I do?
The way to correct it is to circle the one you really wanted. Just make it absolutely clear so that when we duplicate your ballot, we'll get it right.
Okay. So I circled the answer I actually wanted and said I meant to put this one with an arrow. Okay. So I have finished my ballot, and inside are two envelopes.
Mm-hmm. So there's a gold envelope. That's your secrecy envelope. And if you'll notice, there's a flap attached to it. Do not tear the flap off. So what we're going to do is put the ballot in the envelope.
Okay.
Going to seal it. Okay, she sealed her envelope. Now she's going to sign it. And there's a handy dandy highlight to tell you right where to do it. We get a lot of questions about having witnesses. You don't have to have witnesses if you sign it. The only thing witnesses are for is for that old school, if you're illiterate and can only make a mark, then two witnesses have to witness your mark.
Okay.
So Karen's security envelope is now ready to go in the outer envelope, so she's going to slide it in.
What if someone forgets to sign this or does not sign their correct name?
We won't be able to match it to our records, and we'll think it's not you, and we will send you a letter saying, hey, your signature was a little wonky. Is this really you? And the letter will tell you how to fix that.
Okay. What if there's no signature? Same thing.
If there's no signature on the inner envelope, then we'll look to see if you left one on the outer. So Karen's now sealing the outer envelope perfectly. She has signed, or is signing the outer envelope.
Same thing, it's highlighted, so you know right where to sign it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So now you're in good shape. Now you're asking about if you forget a signature. If you give us one out of the two, we're going to match you up and it'll count, as long as everything else in the ballot package is good. There are a number of relaxed rules this time. We're trying to make it to where folks don't get their ballots. We want to get our rejection rate as close to zero as possible. So if your signature doesn't match, we send you a letter and say, hey, help us out here. It looks like it's not you. If your ballot is hopelessly messed up and we have to reject it, we still send you a letter and say, hey, we couldn't make heads or tails out of your ballot. So what we're going to do is cancel it. And now you can go vote in person. That way you still get your shot at voting.
And Don, we just had a situation in Louisville where I think 112 absentee ballots were not delivered. We have not gotten any reports of that happening here in Central Kentucky or anywhere else so far yet in the state. But what can people do if they haven't gotten their absentee ballot yet and they're concerned?
Oh, great question. So by now, everybody in Kentucky should have received their absentee ballot. So if you have not received it, you need to call your county clerk as soon as possible so that they can reissue you a ballot so that there's still time for this whole process to flesh out. As of October the 28th, if you still haven't received it by October the 28th, you're now out of runway, so to speak, for doing it by mail. So what we'll do is call your county clerk, we'll cancel your application in the system, which enables you to go vote in person. That's a fail-safe.
What if it's on voting day and you haven't gotten it?
Same answer. After the 28th, at any point up until election day, you can call the office of your county clerk, have your ballot canceled, and then go vote in person.
Okay, great. How do you feel it's going?
I think it's going very well. Effectively, the Secretary of State asked us to run three simultaneous elections. A vote by mail, which 95,000 ballots is enough that you have to really focus on it. In a normal presidential, the most we've had has been 5,000 ballots, just to give you an idea of the scale here. But then we also did early voting, which requires a lot of management. My staff is upstairs right now fielding calls and all kinds of stuff every day, managing that election. If we were to have a normal election day election where we had 145 plus locations, 286 precincts. There's no way we could have pulled that off this year. We're at max management capacity. My staff is working 6 days a week. I'm working seven, just to give you some idea of how hard this is. So what effectively we did in Fayette County is say, we're going to give you a great mail-in election, we're going to give you a great early voting election, and we're going to cheat a little bit and skimp on the election day because we're just out of resources, and hope that people are smart and spread out the vote over those 3 weeks. If they do, we're going to be just fine.
You said there was a little bit of a hiccup on day one for early voting, but how have things been going at the precinct so far?
Once we got through that little initial, it was a training issue, easily resolved, and we moved on. There's been no problem since, other than normal things. We have a machine go down here or there. We send out a replacement. It's all good. Really, it's going very smoothly. I've been very pleased so far. The main challenge for Fayette County has been that we are limited, very limited, in the locations that were available to us. So we're lucky to have cobbled together eight, believe it or not. And I think they're strategically placed geographically to hit all our residential areas. It seems to be working very well. I will address one thing. A lot of people have volunteered, but they misunderstand that what they think they're doing is volunteering for just election day. We always have had plenty of people for that. It's the 3 week period prior to election day that's the real struggle. And there we had a very pleasant surprise. We recruited about 85, 86 people to run the various locations for us. We easily got those. I was so pleased. Lexington is such a great city. You all, we step up every time I need something like that. So it's been such a community effort this time. You think about BCTC's with me, the city's with me, the schools are with me, the libraries even are with me. That's how you do it. This is the right way for a community to work.
You've already started counting votes, but nobody knows what the results are, right?
Right.
How does that work?
So we won't produce the tapes and counts off the machines that we're doing for the absentee ballots until Election Day. We'll publish all the results from Election Day voting, all the results from early voting, plus all the results from absentee voting up to that point on election night. So you're going to get, I don't know, 80 to 90%. It'll depend on how many people send in their ballots early, but we'll have a pretty accurate estimate for what the results are going to be. Again, on the Friday after Election Day, we'll upload more results by the current regulation. And then the following Tuesday is the official, absolute, you got to have perfect certified results.
So right after my interview with Fayette County Clerk Don Blevins, I went outside. There is a blue drop box right outside the clerk's office, and I dropped off my absentee ballot. I waited a few days, and I wanted to make sure it was counted. You can do the same. You need to visit vrsws.soes.ky.gov/vic/. You just fill out the information and it will tell you if your vote has been processed. I'm Karen Czar reporting for this special edition of Elections 2020.
With a red-hot presidential race dominating election coverage, little attention has been paid to a pair of constitutional amendments also on the ballot in Kentucky. WUKY's Josh James fills us in.
If the first of the proposed amendments sounds familiar, that's because Kentucky voters already overwhelmingly approved it back in 2018. But it was overturned over concerns about the wording on the ballot. The Supreme Court found it too generic, but the Crime Victims' Rights Bill, known as Marcy's Law, is back in 2020, this time in its entirety.
We're obviously trying to comply with the Supreme Court's ruling.
Marcy's Law champion Senator Whitney Westerfield, who helped successfully get the measure back in front of voters. If the state sees a repeat of the vote 2 years ago, a number of guarantees for crime victims will be added to the state constitution.
These rights are things like rights to be treated with fairness and due consideration for the victim's safety, dignity, and privacy. It also gives you the constitutional right to be heard at sentencing of the accused. The proceedings to be free from unreasonable delays, to be present at trials, to consult with state's attorneys, and to be given reasonable protection from the accused, and also be notified about any release or escape of the accused.
And if those sound like things that should already exist, University of Kentucky political science professor Justin Wedeking says you're on to something.
Most of these rights are already in statutory law in Kentucky, but sometimes those things occasionally get forgotten about, they get ignored, there can be clerical errors. And so making it a constitutional right makes it, in some sense, harder to ignore in that respect.
But Marcy's Law, which is part of a national campaign bankrolled by billionaire Henry Nicholas in honor of his sister Marcy, who was murdered in 1983.
Do you know what it's like to lose someone you love?
Is not without its critics.
There's no consensus on this bill in the legal community. I can assure you that.
Senator John Schickel, a staunch Republican, echoing concerns also raised by the ACLU. Among them, the language in the law is inconsistent, confusing, and sets up a potential clash between the rights of victims and the rights of the accused. Again, Justin Wiedeking.
This is a big change in public policy in the sense that nobody really knows how these effects will take place down the road. In the abstract, people obviously who wouldn't like more rights, but we don't know how those rights might impact future criminal investigations. And so a lot of unknowns are with this amendment.
Still, Marcy's Law has won passage in more than 10 states, including California, Florida, and Ohio, and it appears poised for another victory in Kentucky. Meanwhile, the second constitutional amendment on the state's ballot is mostly concerned with expanding terms for some state judicial offices.
The first thing would increase the term length for Commonwealth attorneys from 6 years to 8 years, and that wouldn't take effect until the year 2030. The second thing it would do is increase the office terms of district judges from 4 years to 8 years, starting in 2022. And district judges are the ones that handle low-level offenses like misdemeanors. And the third thing that Amendment 2 would do is would change the licensing requirement for district court judges to require 8 years of service as an attorney instead of 2 years. And this would go into effect much earlier in the year 2022.
Supporters see the changes as a way to increase levels of experience in those holding the offices and bring the term limits in line with other state judges. But Wiedeking says opponents worry about accountability to voters.
If a judge does something in between that they're not happy with, you have to wait until the next election to try to vote them out of office.
While both amendments are wordy, voters will have to choose between a simple yes or no at the ballot box. For 91.3 WUKY News, I'm Josh James.
As we roll through this very unusual election cycle, imagine being someone who has never cast a ballot before. WUKY's Samantha Letterman recently Zoom chatted with some young adults getting ready to exercise their right.
A couple of weeks ago, I talked to four first-time voters, all 18-year-olds who attended high school here in Lexington. I asked them if they were excited to vote and if they think their vote matters. Walt McGavran graduated from Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School and is now studying maths and chemistry at Loyola Chicago.
You know, a lot of people consider voting be a right, which it is. Not everybody in the world has that right. But I think that it transcends that and is really more of a civic responsibility than anything. I think that people should feel obligated to vote because when you're not voting, you're not participating in the democracy. And that's kind of a key tenet to how our country functions. And especially like your vote can be especially important because sometimes you're voting for underrepresented peoples or groups who for various reasons can't vote, or you're voting to give them the ability to vote. So I think that where you're voting to preserve, say, you know, environmental integrity. So I think it's really more of a responsibility than a right, in at least here, and certainly probably in most countries where you have, you know, mass democratic voting.
Beck Boggs attended Henry Clay High School and is currently a freshman at UC Boulder, undecided on his major.
I do think our generation is very, I think, politically minded, maybe more so than previous generations have been in the past. Just because I think with social media and I guess the polarization that kind of goes on during like Facebook and Twitter and stuff like that, where you end up like just ending up with the groups that you like, and thinking like we get up with like an us versus them mentality. I think that really, while not generally a good thing, tends to make people more politically minded, and definitely has motivated us, I think, to vote a lot more than previous generations have, just with the internet and social media and stuff.
Isabel Feld is also a Henry Clay High School graduate and is at Miami of Ohio studying marketing.
Yeah, I definitely agree that generations are becoming more and more politically active. But in the terms of if my vote will like matter, kind of, it's definitely frustrating to live in it, like to be voting in a state like Kentucky, where I know like most likely it doesn't really make that much of a difference. But I'm still going to vote every single year, no matter where I live or where I'm registered.
And now that she's away at college.
Since Miami University is in Ohio, that's a huge swing state in this upcoming election. And the people I've met, we've like kind of talked about politics a little bit, and it's really interesting to see like how kind of split everyone is. Like I probably met an equal amount of, you know, the left and the right. And so I think that definitely hasn't changed my vote, but I just think it's interesting to like be in a swing state at this like important election.
Lee Helmers graduated from Sayre High School and has just started his freshman year at the University of Denver. He's undecided on his major.
I've definitely had quite a culture shock coming from Kentucky to Colorado. It's not the same when it comes to politics in the slightest, but I don't think my personal opinions have changed much. I maybe have become more vocal, but I don't think anybody's really changing my opinions besides myself.
Walt maintains that their vote matters.
It's hard to say that any single vote makes a difference, but I think that when you have groups of people who are all jointly motivated, that's when it becomes a difference. And then you have this whole is maybe greater than the sum of its parts, which is perhaps counterintuitive to the way a lot of things work. So in that regard, I guess I'll contradict myself and say that an individual vote is important. But on its own, no, but when it works in tandem and people are motivated to change things, that's when it becomes powerful. And yeah, I would say this generation is certainly more politically active maybe than the generation that preceded it. I would say it's fairly similar to the way that Gen X operated as youth in this country. And I think that over the next decade, you'll probably see a pretty axiomatic shift in the way that politics is both worked and thought about.
Beck confirms he was definitely motivated to vote.
Yeah, I mean, I was definitely excited to vote. Like, this is one of the biggest elections. Well, of course, the only election that I've been able to vote in so far. I've been trying to stay well informed. I knew like my vote was going to be important. So, I was excited to vote, I think, this year, especially for this election.
Because Loyola is currently online, Walt plans to vote in person here in Fayette County and told us how he gets most of his news and information.
Yeah, I read quite a bit of Politico and the BBC, depending on what particular political topic it's about. I'll read the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, Washington Post. If I want unedited footage, I guess sometimes I'll go to C-SPAN. I would say I'm pretty diligent about the sourcing of my information. And also fairly prolific in the amount that I consume.
And Beck?
I probably, like most of us, get a lot of my information and news from social media. Of course, I don't take it all at like first glance. If it seems important, then I'll like read the article and I'll try and look at different sources on the stuff, because I don't like to trust just one news source on anything. But I feel like that's a pretty reliable way of staying informed, especially you know, in the information age when there's so much information everywhere on the internet. So right now it's currently like social media, but I try to look at like trusted sources and stuff like that.
Before we wrapped up, I asked them all for their final thoughts, starting with Lee.
You know, I'm excited to see what happens in the next few decades. As, you know, the older generations move on, and our generation kind of moves forward, I'm really excited to see where America goes.
Then Walt.
I would say that, you know, politics and voting and, you know, just the general consciousness of the nation is pretty cyclical. So right now it seems like we're swinging towards a more, I guess you would say, liberal worldview in the nation, which is funny to say because we, you know, the past election showed a fairly populist view. And I think that in 50 years, we may just as well swing back to a more conservative view. It's hard to stay in one area, but I guess the hope is that we can stay maybe in the liberal view longer. History does bear out that progressivism works.
Beck.
Well, I guess the only thing I have to add is that honestly, that I'm excited to vote and I'm really happy, like with the, like, because on social media, like I see a lot of people my age that are all also really excited to vote. And I'm really happy that we're just such a politically minded generation. And I'm, you know, I'm glad to see that.
And the last word goes to Isabel.
I agree with that. I think the amount of things that I've seen telling young people to vote and how important our vote is, I'm really excited to see if there's like a bigger voter turnout this year than past years. And so I'm really excited to have my voice matter this year.
My thanks to all four of them for taking the time to get together and discuss this for WUKY. For WUKY News, I'm Samantha Lederman.
An exhibit at the University of Kentucky Art Museum seeks to foster important conversations about American history and the major socio-political issues of the current moment, including voting. As WUKY's Arlo Barnett explains, the show was assembled to coincide with the 2020 election.
The exhibit is called This Is America, a nod to the 2018 song and video by Childish Gambino, which treat issues of race and gun violence in the country. In the show's title, the word America has an asterisk attached to it. Museum director Stuart Harodner says the punctuation indicates an omission or blemish in an otherwise outstanding achievement. In this case, it represents the gap between the promises of America and the delivery of those promises. The show opens with a portrait of George Washington placed directly beside the animated face of George Floyd.
You will be able to look at, you know, George Washington's face next to George Floyd's face, their eyes almost completely on a line. And in a way, I could maybe make a case that the entire history of America right now could be collapsed into the story of the two Georges.
Harodner says America is a concept as much as a place, and it's been fraught with contradiction from the beginning. A slaveholding founding father and a black man recently killed by police isn't the only provocative contrast set up by the exhibit. Andy Warhol's pop art is featured near a poem by Frank X. Walker, along with a 10-by-13-foot painting of the moment when a woman was struck and killed by a car in 2017 while peacefully protesting in Charlottesville. Next to paintings, jars of dirt.
There's some little samples of soil in the exhibit, works by the artist Louis Zoller Bickett, who was a Lexington artist. And they're little bottles that contain soil from Martin Luther King's house in Atlanta, Independence Hall in Philadelphia, the lower Ninth Ward after Hurricane Katrina, ash and debris from the World Trade Center after 9/11. Okay? These simple little collections of dirt and soil in little bottles on a pedestal, to me, they're unbelievably powerful.
Harodner feels the relevance of pieces to the modern day isn't diminished by their age.
Hey, what cultural production from the past or the present helps us understand this moment? I find it absolutely fascinating and very to the point that many people are rereading or reading for the first time James Baldwin's writing from the 50s and 60s. Not to say that other writers working in the contemporary mode are not like who we should be. Well, we should be reading a lot of stuff. But there are, you know, voices that seem particularly helpful or relevant at the moment. So it can be in its time and unbelievably helpful in another time.
Hrodner dedicated the exhibit to the late Senator John Lewis, who died in July. The curator used to live in Atlanta and got to meet Lewis in person.
This is a guy who not only put his personal life on the line for issues of civil rights and social justice, but also saw in the arc of his life unbelievable progress and crushing setbacks, from Selma to, let's say, the election of Barack Obama, to progress in the Voting Rights Act. Well, but in the last couple of years, you've had unbelievable anxiety and tension and horror and tragedy in terms of protest marches and murders and police aggression and all kinds of stuff that, you know, it's like, and I watched John Lewis, you know, like, speak about these challenges. And he seemed to, unbelievably, never lose his optimism, even when you knew this had to be, like, horrible for him to, like, watch it go so far forward and then slam sideways or go backwards. And you realize that, you know, history and the country is always, like, adjusting, you know. And this isn't about, like, your particular political persuasion. This is just about what your aspirations are, let's say, for your family or people you love or yourself. Wouldn't it be great if you're, let's say, a queer couple to imagine that 5 years ago when you were a loving couple, you could not get married. And maybe a year or two, you chose to get married. And now you may be thinking about the future of the Supreme Court and whether that legal capacity is now going to be altered.
Hrodner says he likes to think Lewis would appreciate the multi-voiced nature of the exhibit. American artists from outside the United States are included, such as Mexican muralist David Alfaro Siqueiros.
Art is often a place, and the museum is often a place where we use that word safe space. You know, my colleague Michaela, who was just here, reminds me that maybe the word is more appropriately a brave space. Like, we're not trying to pretend that you can be unhitched from something that might disturb you. Actually, the opposite. We try to create a thoughtful space where you can be confronted by something that upsets you, but you are in the embrace of the institution with information, with staff, with context that can help you navigate your feelings, right? It felt really important to create opportunities for students, for faculty, for community who feel, you know, unbelievably put on by living in this moment, to have a place where they can come and see some other reflections on the times we're dealing with.
Hrodner and his colleagues put together a 50-song Spotify playlist to accompany the exhibit, with selections from Dolly Parton's 9 to 5 to Strange Fruit, as sung by Billie Holiday, to American Pie by Don McLean. The show, This Is America, runs through February 13th at the UK Art Museum. Arlo Barnett, WUKY News.
From the pandemic to concerns about voter suppression to a president casting doubt on the process, many election watchers worry a perfect storm is brewing in the 2020 general election. WUKY's Josh James asked University of Kentucky election law expert Joshua Douglas for his best and worst case scenarios.
What's the most likely scenario?
New warnings from the U.S. Postal Service are coming to light.
Can you give a direct answer? You will accept the election?
I have to see.
Latest CNN poll shows this race is far from over.
Okay, first, stop. Take a deep breath. Now, let's start with something relaxing. Something that's maybe on the optimistic side, but still worth hearing. The best case scenario.
So election administrators have what is sometimes referred to as the election administrator's prayer. Please don't let this be a close one.
It's an appeal that works just as well for election law professors, like UK's Joshua Douglas, who says the more decisive the tallies, the more potential pitfalls we sidestep.
If it's a blowout, then we avoid a lot of the really problematic scenarios that might come about. Now, that doesn't mean that our system is working perfectly, but it does at least avoid some of the really sort of scary scenarios that people are talking about in this year's election.
So let's review. In a typical year, voters cast their ballots. Those are totaled up. The state determines the winner of its electoral college votes. That's 8 in Kentucky. And those are transmitted to Washington, D.C. On the following January 6, Congress officially counts the vote, and the candidate with the majority, 270 or more, is declared the winner. Simple, right? Okay. Enter 2020. I asked Professor Douglas how he thinks a contested race would most likely play out. One problem, he says, might start with the party's voting preferences. That is, Democrats leaning more toward mail-in and Republicans tending to vote on Election Day. Toss in some confusion in some states about when absentee ballots can be counted, and it could give a false impression on November 3rd.
I fear what's been referred to as the red mirage, that is, the Republicans looking very strong on election night, that creates confusion and creates an opportunity for someone like President Trump to declare victory prematurely, and then the big blue shift when all the votes are actually cast and the tensions that would put on our system.
Douglas worries that scenario would open the door to unsubstantiated claims of fraud and election integrity concerns. Things would get even murkier legally if that results in a state sending conflicting slates of electors to Washington. The chief reason red lights are blinking for Douglas, however, is the current commander-in-chief, specifically statements like this one he made at a rally in Delaware.
I will totally accept the results of this great and historic presidential election if I win.
If the once far-fetched but now plausible occurs and President Trump refuses to accept a win by former Vice President Joe Biden and can't produce evidence of fraud, Douglas says we could see an outcome not unlike a recent episode in Kentucky history.
We saw kind of a mini version of this happen in 2019 in Kentucky, where Matt Bevin had lost the election to Andy Beshear by about 5,000 votes. And for about a week, he was claiming election integrity concerns, not believing the outcome, and, you know, laying the potential groundwork for contesting the election in the state legislature.
We know there have been thousands of absentee ballots that were illegally counted. That is known, and this, again, is something that's being looked into.
And what we saw was his fellow party, the Republicans, basically said, look, give us the evidence, put up or shut up. And if you don't have any evidence of shenanigans, of election integrity issues, real evidence, then you lost. And it took a week, and it took more and more people saying that. But eventually, I think Bevin got the message.
The big question mark, would GOP leaders in Washington, who have so far fallen in line behind Trump, begin to peel away? That answer could be up to powerful Republicans like Kentucky's Mitch McConnell, who did push back when the president sowed doubt in September about a peaceful transfer of power if he loses the election. This is Senator McConnell on Fox.
We've had an orderly transfer of power every 4 years since Washington was selected for a second term in 1792. That will happen again to the winner of the November 3rd election on January the 20th, 2021.
But what happens between now and that date is anything but certain. For 91.3 WUKY News, I'm Josh James.
You've been listening to Voting in the Age of COVID-19, featuring the WUKY News team, Karen Czar, Josh James, Samantha Letterman, Dan Collins, and Arlo Barnett. I'm WUKY News Director Alan Lytle. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to vote.